This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with DJ, musician, and record producer Mark Ronson. His song Uptown Funk recently spent 14 weeks at the top of Billboard's Hot 100 chart. The song's vocal is by Bruno Mars, who co-wrote the song, but the album it's from, Uptown Special, is a Mark Ronson album. Ronson has put out 4 albums under his own name, and they all feature other artists singing the songs he co-wrote and produced. Ronson's production work on the Amy Winehouse album, Back to Black, helped to make international hits out of her songs Rehab and You Know I'm No Good. Ronson was born in London, but his family moved to New York when he was 8. He's now a much sought-after producer and has done recordings with Adele, Paul McCartney, Ghostface Killah, Lily Allen, and Duran Duran. This is his current hit, Uptown Funk.
This is that ice cold Michelle, fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Stylin', wildin', living it up in the city. Got Chucks on with Saint Laurent, gotta kiss myself, I'm so pretty. I'm too hot. Call the police and the fireman, I'm too hot. Make a dragon wanna retire, man, I'm too hot. Say my name, you know who I am, I'm too hot. And my band bought that money, break it down. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Saturday night and we in the spot. Don't believe me, just watch.
That's Bruno Mars, Uptown Funk, produced by my guest, Mark Ronson. Mark Ronson, welcome to Fresh Air. What a great track. So you play guitar on this track. And
yes, I play guitar and I co-wrote it, yeah.
So I'm going to ask you to tell the story about how stressed out you were when you were recording your guitar part for the track.
You know, we've been working on this song for quite a long time. And, you know, like a lot of songs, the first time that we had that jam, you know, everybody's so excited. We got like this kind of like little instrumental track with a few words, enough words to put together like the first verse. There's nothing more exciting than that period of the song because the potential is, you know, unlimited, and it's just like that initial phase of creation is exciting. And then every time you get back to sort of try and work on it, you can never get that spirit back, and you try and write another verse and it seems forced because the first one was so natural. And, you know, there were so many times, whether we were doing sessions in LA or because Bruno was on tour, you know, I'd go to Canada or sometimes in London. We were recording most of my album in Memphis, so he would come there. We'd work on the song and we weren't exactly at each other's throats, but we had just had it with staring at each other in a room and just, man, maybe this song wasn't meant to be. But because this song was for my album and I kind of realized the potential and from that first little bit of excitement, I kept fighting for it. I'd wait, you know, maybe a month till everyone's nerves cooled down and be like, hey, can we get back in and try and work on that song again? And eventually we did get it. And one of the last things to happen was to get my guitar part. I guess just the pressure of knowing I still had to like come up with something to basically like my end of the deal. And everyone else had done this great, you know, Bruno had done this great vocal. Jeff had all these great synth parts. And while we were doing the guitars, I've done 50, 60 takes of it. And I couldn't get a part that I liked. And we went out for lunch and I guess the pressure of the song and the guitar part, I fainted in a restaurant and I was kind of like, let's just say I like redecorated the walls in the bathroom at this nice restaurant and had to be carried out. And luckily I went to Toronto 2 days later because that's where Bruno happened to be on tour to work on some other stuff for the song. And I got it there. It just became easy. And maybe it was just psychological getting out of home, whatever it was.
So obviously it was very stressful producing this track. And what's interesting about that is that the track has so much kind of joy, and even though I said it doesn't sound spontaneous, it sounds like it was really kind of well thought out before. There's a spontaneous feeling to it. And to hear how stressed out you were about it and how many takes there were and how maybe it almost didn't even happen because you and Bruno Mars thought maybe it wasn't meant to happen. It seems so at odds with the actual sound of the recording.
I think everything that actually ended up on the final track is joy. Like, you know, even if we might have re-recorded the drum take from the original, like Bruno when he played that thing, like we were always excited at every moment about this song. It was so much fun. You know, it's kind of okay to take a long time to get a guitar bit and a performance, because when you finally get the part that you like, it feels incredible to play. Like, it was just like getting that thing to as good as we knew it could be. You know, Bruno was on tour. He'd come off stage playing these arenas every night and go straight to his dressing room where he had his engineer, like, you know, everyone else is going out and partying. He's just like sitting in there like, okay, how do we make this bass line better for this song, you know? But what we started originally, this song, which was like jamming with three individuals who I very much love to play music with, and just our love of that kind of music comes through. And thank God that comes through, because that's kind of the best part.
What does it mean to be a producer? I think a lot of people don't really know. What does it mean for you to be a... I mean, like, you're a real hands-on producer, so what does it mean when you're producing something?
I think, you know, for me, it's sort of like whatever the most appropriate job I have. I'm, you know, if I'm producing a record for another artist or a band or a rapper, it's like whatever I need to slot into to make that music the best it can be, or help the artist or whoever I'm working with achieve whatever vision they have in their head for a song. So sometimes if I'm working with a rapper like Ghostface Killah or Nas, producing usually means in hip hop that you make the music, you make the beat, and you give it to them and they write the rhymes. Then, you know, the other more traditional role of the producer, in like the kind of Quincy Jones sense, is kind of part arranger. So you're coming up with it, like these, you hear these songs that are quite bare bones, and you dream up what's the band doing, what's the rhythm section doing, what's the guitars, strings, pianos, that sort of thing. It's almost like a little toolbox. You just pick up a little bit of whatever the ones you think are appropriate, and you try and, you know, combine them, and then you bring in other people that are great for the things that you're not so good at. So when I was working with Amy Winehouse on Back to Black, you know, she had all these beautiful songs, incredibly well written, and just her on the acoustic nylon string guitar, and she would play them for me, and then I would kind of drum up my idea of what I thought, make a demo with what I thought the drum should be doing, the guitar is like quite a crude demo, and then I'd play it for her, and if she liked it, we'd run with it, and then eventually we got the Dap Kings into record, and that was that. And then I guess, you know, on this record, on my album, it's a bit different, because I'm, you know, I'm writing a lot of the music, so it kind of starts with me writing the songs, or writing songs with Jeff Basker and Michael Chabon in this instance, and then going from there.
We mentioned Amy Winehouse. So let's talk about the huge hit album that you had with her, Back to Black. I know you produced most but not all the tracks on that album. You produced You Know I'm No Good, right?
Yeah.
Good. Let's hear that one. And I'm choosing that because it's a great recording, and also the horns stand out so well on it. And that was all you're doing, getting the Dap Kings to perform with her. So why don't we hear that? And then we'll talk about it. So this is the late Amy Winehouse. The song is You Know I'm No Good, and it's from her album Back to Black, which was largely produced by my guest Mark Ronson.
Me out like I'm
the late Amy Winehouse. Her song, You Know I'm No Good, that track was produced by my guest, Mark Ronson, who produced most of that album, Back to Black, which was a huge hit. So the way you were describing it, it sounds like she played you maybe a demo of the song. What did you hear in your mind, and how did you put that together for what became the final recording?
Well, on this song, this is really one of the best examples of one of the songs that the Dap Kings, you know, the musicians who played on this stuff, really brought to life. Because of the chords and the way Amy had played the song, I had always thought of it almost as like a kind of Latin, like, I feel so ignorant, but I don't even know if it's samba, what is it? But it was originally like, dum, and that's how I had the demo, and I kind of got in and I just told the band, I was like, here's my arrangement, but I'm not really feeling it, so why don't you guys just like hit on a groove or how you would play this chord chart. And Homer and Nick, the drummer and the bass player from the Dap Kings, one of the most incredible rhythm sections, probably the most incredible rhythm section I've ever worked with, just came up with that doom, mm, 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 and that I was one of the really musical best moments of my life just hearing that. And it was really like the second day I'd started working with the Dap Kings. I never even recorded a full band before. It just instantly changed the song. And then Dave Guy and the Neil came up with that horn line, and that was when I really discovered the magic of the Dap Kings and how, you know, very much like the Wrecking Crew in L.A. and, you know, the Funk Brothers, like, are a special group of musicians that really just bring you something that nobody else does.
So how did you get to work with Amy Winehouse? How did she approach you? Were you matched up by someone else?
Basically, there's a good friend of mine who works at EMI Publishing, a publishing company. He had asked me, he was like, you know, do you know this girl, Amy Winehouse? She's in New York for a day. She's kind of meeting people to maybe work with on her second album. And I remember that about 3 years before that, her first record had come out. And I just remember really liking this one song off it called In My Bed and being a little bit enamored, this young kind of Jewish girl from North London. You know, I have the same thing from a Jewish family from North London, with this incredible voice. And so I said, yeah, I'll meet her. And, you know, to be honest, I wasn't like I was some big shot. Like at that point, you know, I was meeting with anybody that might want to work on music, you know, because you never know where chemistry is going to come or your break or whatever it is. So she came to my studio one day, and I was on Mercer Street, Mercer and Canal in downtown New York, and we hung out, talked about music. You know, she was so magnetic, and I guess her energy, like, I just instantly liked her, and I wanted to impress her, basically. Like, I wanted to have a piece of music that would make her be like, wow, I want to work with this guy, you know, for lack of a better words. And so I said, well, why don't you go home back to the hotel, and I'll work on something tonight and see, you know, come back tomorrow, and I'll play you a little piece of music and see if you're into it. So she had played me all this stuff in the Shangri-Las, and I was all this 60s girl group pop that she was into, and I was kind of inspired. And she came back, and I had the next morning the piano chords for Back to Black and the kind of little skeleton beat with the tambourine, and I just put a bunch of cheap reverb on it because I thought, like, that's what that sound was supposed to be like. And she really dug it, and that's how we ended up. She ended up staying in New York another week, so we worked on, you know, the rest of the songs that she had.
Was it odd for her, for you, when she had the hit of Rehab, knowing that she really did have drug and alcohol problems, that Rehab really was an issue in her life?
I guess because at the point that I met her, she was pretty much sober and, you know, the most together she had been maybe like in years. So it was strange because everyone was telling me these stories like, you know, oh, you're working with Amy Winehouse, oh, good luck, like, I heard she's been working on this record for 3 years or blah blah blah, and I just had no idea what everyone was talking about because she came into New York, she had these songs, she seemed to be creatively on fire, she wrote Back to Black and Rehab while we were there in the studio in, like, you know, kind of a matter of hours. And so she was good. So when she was telling me the story about Rehab, we were actually walking down the street, and she was saying, you know, there was this time like a couple of years ago and I was in this dark place and my family came over and some friends and they tried to make me go to rehab and I was like, psh, no, no, no. And she put up her hand and I just thought like, that's such a catchy kind of turn of phrase. And would you, you know, should we go back and just maybe do you want to try and write a song with that? Because it just instantly sounded like a hook to me. So it very much sounded like something that had happened in her life and she had kind of moved past. So there was never any kind of weird, like, yes, if she was like, if she had terrible problems and was drinking every day in the studio, there's no way I would have said like, oh, that's a great idea for a song. But because it felt like something that she had kind of, you know, just overcome, it didn't seem like a bad idea.
You know, the way you tell that story, it sounds like one of those musical biopics where someone's having a conversation and suddenly they turn it into a song. The kind of thing that seems to rarely happen in real life. It's amazing that that song actually started out that way.
Yeah, you know, I'm so like hesitant to do anything that's kind of like, you know, gimmicky and that kind of thing. But she just said it and it just felt so natural and it really just sounded like a song. I mean, we're standing on the corner of Green Street and Spring downtown. Like, I remember it so well. And I was just like, she's telling me this really deep story. Like, is it kind of like gross that I'm like, just all I can hear is like a big pop hook in there. But she understood that where it was kind of coming from and was into the idea.
Why don't we hear a little bit of that? And this is Amy Winehouse, and the track is Rehab. It's produced by my guest, Mark Ronson.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
So, Mark, you come from a really musical family. Your stepfather is Mick Jones, who is the guitarist in the band Foreigner and wrote one of their biggest hits, I Want to Know What Love Is. So let's just hear a few seconds of that song to refresh people's memory.
In my life, there's been heartache and pain. I don't know if I can face it again.
So that's Foreigner, a song written by my guest Mark Ronson's stepfather, Mick Jones. So how old were you when that song was released?
I think that was about maybe 10 years old. You know, that's he met my mom when I was about 7, and then we moved to New York. We lived in London at the time when she got married to him, and then he wrote that song for her. So it's kind of amazing. I mean, my wife is always like, I don't write lyrics, so I can like really technically write a song for anyone. I could write a very nice instrumental. So she always sort of gives me a hard time because it's just such a ridiculously impossible standard to live up to that your stepdad wrote that song for your mom. But yeah.
You started off by DJing. What was it like at the beginning? What kind of places did you DJ? And, you know, how many turntables did you have early on?
I started off DJing probably like, you know, I was about 16 and I had 2 turntables and I just had maybe a handful of records, maybe 10 records, and I'd buy 2 copies of the same records so I could practice scratching them and bringing the breaks back, you know, by emulating my favorite DJs on the radio, which were like Stretch Armstrong and Funkmaster Flex, Red Alert. I would listen to their routines and try and copy what they were doing. Because I didn't really know anyone else who was a DJ who could really teach me or show me the stuff. And, you know, like anything in the beginning, you just play wherever you can. You just, like, someone's doing a gig, they got $20. Like, you're there with your whole, you know, speaker system and turntables. Literally, my first DJ gig was at bar where they served underage kids on the Upper East Side on like 2nd Avenue, and I brought my entire PA and turntables in a snowstorm for, you know, $50, because you just can't wait to, you love this stuff so much, you just can't wait to kind of get out and do it, and, you know, you're just like, any way that I can get discovered. And then after a couple of years of playing in clubs in downtown New York, you know, people like Puffy and Guru and Premier from Gangstar and Biggie and Jay-Z and all these kind of heroes of mine are suddenly coming into these places where I'm DJing, and, you know, it was like a thrill, and if you do a good job, there's a chance they might remember who you are. And that happened with Puffy, and he started to like kind of book me for other gigs, and later on with Jay-Z as well. So that's sort of how I started to make my name.
So what has been the impact for you on your life and your career of having a really big hit again, Uptown Funk?
You know, it's weird. It hasn't really changed my life in any kind of way that I can measure. I mean, it's obviously such an insanely amazing thing. You know, none of my other records I've ever had before even broke into the top 100. You know, like there's songs like Valerie and Bang 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 that I was so proud of, and, you know, the level of success that they had, if they were little cult hits, meant that, you know, I could sell out Webster Hall or Williamsburg Music Hall or the El Rey Theater in L.A. Like, that was having made it to me. So the thought of having a number one song in my own career, like, never even registered, and it's insane. And, you know, I know that music is kind of it's like a finicky industry to be in, of course. Like, tastes change, you're hot one minute, you're not. You know, I've been through it quite a few times, like, on both sides of it. And I guess the best thing about having a successful record like this is, like, I know I'm at least good for another 5 years, like, before everyone starts to, like, all the haters start to come out again. And that's really what it is. It's like every time you have one of these, you're sort of, your lease is renewed another 5 years. And that's kind of great for me, because that's all I really want to be doing still at this point, like, just making records and getting to work with, like, artists that I think are exciting.
Mark Ronson's latest album, Uptown Special, includes the hit Uptown Funk. You can hear a longer version of Terry's conversation with Ronson on our podcast at iTunes.com/freshair. The band The Mountain Goats has a new album called Beat the Champ. It's unusual in that it's a concept album about professional wrestling. Band leader John Darnielle has been interested in the sport since he was a boy. Darnielle is also a prose writer whose novel Wolf in White Van was nominated for a National Book Award in 2014. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Beat the Champ.
Get stomped like a snake. Lie down in the dirt. Cling to my convictions. Even when I get hurt. Be an upstanding, well-loved man about town. In your child's mind, that's how it goes down. But I tried the losing side. I don't want to die in here. I don't want to die in here.
When I read that the new Mountain Goats album was a song cycle about pro wrestling, I could almost hear the interest in my brain click off. Hey, I like professional fighting as much as the next guy, though mixed martial arts is more my thing. But I made the stupid assumption that rock songs about wrestling would be as loud and aggressive and maybe as willfully stupid as pro wrestling is. I should have given the brain behind Mountain Goats, John Darnielle, more credit. It turns out that this is a transfixing collection, filled with a remarkable range of melodies and moods.
Cage free for all. Through the noise I hear you call for help. You can't protect yourself. Frog mask and yellow cape. So desperate to escape I came to you. Hands wrapped in adhesive tape. That was when we were young and green.
That's Animal Mask, about the costumes or gimmicks fighters use, the colorful characters wrestlers embody, and which captured the imagination of John Darnielle when he was a kid. Throughout this album, Darnielle executes twisting turns of memory, nostalgia, and reporting, as he describes what it was like to find escape and inspiration in the fights he saw on TV or staged in Los Angeles's Grand Olympic Auditorium, a magnificently grungy sight. Sometime during the late 70s, I myself went to see a fight there with the rock critic Richard Meltzer, as well as checking out the punk rock acts that the Olympic occasionally booked. A couple of aspects of this collection merit special attention. The first is that Darnielle's vocals here are as elastic, varied, and expressive as anything he's ever recorded. The other is the impressive variety of tunes he has composed, from acoustic pop to brawny rock, and a middle ground that lends itself to storytelling, such as this salute to one of Darnielle's favorite real-life wrestlers, the legend of Chavo Guerrero.
Born down in El Paso, where the tumbleweeds blow, to the middleweight champ of all Mexico. Dad fought many bloody battles, and he raised four sons. Chavo was the oldest one. Old man Gory could pop like a live grenade. Raised his boys in the way of the trade. Hector and Mondo, young Eddie G. Chavo meant the most to me. Look high, it's my last hope. Chavo Guerrero, coming off the top rope. He came from Texas seeking fortune.
This album isn't all fondly phrased nostalgia. It doesn't shy away from the violence and crumminess and crudity of its subject. Darnielle executes his own version of a wrestler's takedown on a blunt song like Foreign Object.
Like a dog, down on the cars, square in the spotlight, sweating real hard. All soaked in blood, like a newborn babe, sharp thing hidden in my hand, shaped like an astrolabe. Gonna stick you in the eye with a foreign object. Gonna poke you in the eye with a foreign object. Poses, keep my weapon hand low, whip my head around a little, get blood on the front row.
Ultimately, this album Beat the Champ isn't just John Darnielle revisiting a youthful passion from the perspective of a canny adult, although that in itself is a significant accomplishment. As he has proven over the years in many Mountain Goats albums, Darnielle is especially good at capturing the way pop culture can serve as an inspiration, a comfort, a refuge for young people feeling besieged by the world around them. He makes you feel the sweat, muscle, and mental exertion it takes to get out from under the heaviest opponents in your life.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed the new album Beat the Champ by the Mountain Goats. Coming up, House of Cards creator Bo Willimon. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with the creator of the Netflix series House of Cards, Bo Willimon. House of Cards stars Kevin Spacey as the ruthless politician Frank Underwood. In the first season of House of Cards, Underwood, a Democrat from South Carolina, was the House Majority Whip. By season two, he'd become vice president. In order to reach the top, Underwood trapped the president in a scandal. And when the president resigned rather than face impeachment, Underwood became the leader of the free world, without the bother of being elected. In the third and latest season, in spite of President Underwood's expertise in the use and abuse of power, he's having a hard time getting his signature legislation passed. It's a bill to fund a program called America Works, which he insists would create full employment. But he wants to drain entitlement programs to fund it. In this scene, he's pitching America Works to his party leaders.
Now, you all have the overview, but what we have here today is the comprehensive breakdown of America.
Sir, before we begin...
Look, Bob, I know you have some serious doubts about this program, but just let me flesh it out first, and then I promise we can address any questions that you might have.
Mr. President...
10 million jobs. Can we all agree that that's a good thing for this country? Universal employment. It's the key for our keeping the White House in 2016. It's the only chance we have of winning back majorities in Congress. Now, the election's only 18 months away. We need to do something bold, something decisive. We need to redefine our party.
Actually, that's what we wanted to discuss. You're right. We do need to redefine the party.
We need to do it with a fresh face.
2016. We don't want you to run.
You weren't even elected to the office in the first place.
The pardons hurt you. Approvals are low.
We're not casting blame, sir. We just believe that this is best for the party.
Bo Willimon, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it's so funny, like, the Frank Underwood character has kind of connived and manipulated his way to the top. His dream has come true. He's now president of the United States. Now that he's the president, it's like he's totally stymied. You know, he can't pass his legislation because Congress is so blocked. His own party leadership doesn't want him to run, you know, to run for the presidency in the next election. He's stymied by the Soviet president. He's sometimes stymied by his wife. It's as if you're making a joke about American politics that when you reach the top, like, you can't do anything.
A lot of people think of the president of the United States as being an incredibly powerful person, which he or she is. But with that power also comes a lot of constrictions, limitations. There's the, you know, there's the harsh glare of the spotlight. And I think for a president like Frank Underwood, who's come into office without a single vote cast for him, tarnished by political scandal from the previous administration, and a whole host of worries at his feet, if he were to come in and it were to be easy, that would have been false to our story. And I think it's also probably false in real life.
So Frank Underwood, who's the president by the third and latest season, is a ruthless politician who really cares only about power. Now, he's a Democrat. Why did you make him a Democrat and not a Republican? What went into that decision?
Two things, really. The first is that the conventional wisdom about Hollywood, which I think is probably supported by fact, is that Hollywood tends to be more liberal than conservative. And if we had made Frank a Republican, I think a lot of people would have assumed that we were trying to take pot shots, that we were trying to say something about the Republican Party. By making him a Democrat, we insulate ourselves from that. And it also points to the fact that it doesn't really matter whether Frank is a Democrat or Republican at all, because he's non-ideological, which leads into the second reason. The tradition of the Southern Democrat, the Democrat that builds his or her power base on personal relationships and local politics and the maneuvering through government as opposed to pure ideological stances seemed right for Frank.
And Frank is from South Carolina, which is I think where your father's from.
That's right. My whole family on my father's side is from South Carolina, going all the way back to the Revolution.
Did you draw on that at all in creating your version of Frank Underwood? Well, your version.
Sure.
I mean, in the British, your version of House of Cards is based on the British series, but he wasn't named Frank Underwood in that, and he certainly wasn't the American president. So.
That's right. In the BBC version, a wonderful version based on Michael Dobbs' novels, actually, it was Francis Urquhart, and he hailed from Scottish aristocracy. He came from privilege. I was much more interested in the American mythology of someone coming from nothing and working their way up to the presidency. You come from a town called Hope, and if you work hard and put in your time, you too can be the president of the United States. Our town isn't called Hope; it's called Gaffney, and Gaffney is a real town in the 5th District of South Carolina. The mayor of it is Hank Chicken Jolly. He happens to be a Democrat. And I know there's a lot of these towns in South Carolina where you know, people might never even dream of being a president, and yet this young man did. I asked my dad, I said, he's from Greenville, I said, what town do you think fits the bill for what we're trying to achieve? And immediately he said Gaffney, and I was sold.
So, you know, typically in political speeches, politicians talk about their wonderful family, how they're loving parents, even if their parents, you know, weren't, you're going to hear about how loving they were. Whereas in House of Cards, when the Kevin Spacey character, the president, visits his father's grave in the small town in South Carolina, he urinates on the tombstone.
Yeah, he sure does. Yeah, and clearly he's been saving up because it's a long and enduring stream. No, I mean one of the beautiful things about the direct address, which is something we outright stole from the BBC version, and which, you know, they stole from Shakespeare, who stole from
Greeks. By direct address, you mean basically the character faces the camera and makes a soliloquy. It's an aside to the viewers.
Absolutely. It gives us access to him in ways that the public can never have access to. We get to look behind the facade. And in that moment, you know, he's talking about, you know, how his father was you know, loved by none. No one showed up for his funeral. Hey, Dad, when they bury me, they're going to have to wait in line. We've heard him talk about his father before on several occasions, and one of those times is when he's giving a sermon in season one, and he's talking about how deeply he loved his father and how heart-wrenching it was when he lost his father. And then he turns to us and he tells us how little he cared about his father, and he's sort of glad that he died, but that doesn't make for a good eulogy. And so, you know, what we're playing with there is the stories, the narratives that politicians often create in order to sell themselves. There is a big aspect of theater to politics, to what is the story I'm presenting that will make me seem powerful or compassionate or someone who feels your pain. And politicians, since the beginning of politics, have found ways to manipulate those stories. And here we just get access to the manipulation.
So why don't we hear one of the soliloquies? And this is from the first episode of the first season. And it's really the first scene that Kevin Spacey is in. And a dog has been run over by a hit-and-run driver. And Kevin Spacey's character is the first to get to the dog. And he, this is his little speech about pain and suffering. And it's the soliloquy to the audience. It's the aside to the audience.
There are two kinds of pain. Sort of pain that makes you strong, or useless pain. Sort of pain that's only suffering. I have no patience for useless things. Moments like this require someone who will act. Do the unpleasant thing, the necessary thing. There. No more pain.
And the thing he's acting to do, the unpleasant thing, he's strangling the dog to get it.
Yeah, that's right. But not on screen. You can't actually see the dog. We had a big debate as to whether we'd see the dog or not, and eventually landed on not seeing the dog. We thought it was much more chilling if you just hear the dog's whimpering off screen. But there were plenty of people involved in the production who said, you know, you can't kill a dog in the first 30 seconds. We'll lose half our audience. You can kill as many people as you want, but if you kill an animal, you're going to lose people. So I go to Fincher, David Fincher, who directed the first two episodes. He's executive producer on the show and really brought the whole team together. And I say, David, people are saying if we kill this dog, we're going to lose half our audience. And you know, he thinks for a second, and he goes, well, I don't give a crap. And I go, I don't either. And I say, he didn't use crap. He used another word. But I said, yeah, me either. Let's do it. And we weren't. It's not that we were being so cavalier. As much as I think we came to the conclusion that whoever watches that scene and still keeps watching is the right audience for our show. And whoever watches that scene and says, this isn't for me, at least we've given them the benefit of knowing in the first 30 seconds this show isn't for them. So why not provide that litmus test right at the beginning? I'm sure we did lose some people from that dog strangling scene, but the people that stuck around knew what they were getting.
And it's not like you're saying this was a good thing to put the dog out of its misery in this way. You're saying that the Kevin Spacey character doesn't even wince. And in fact, it leads him to state his philosophy of life, you know?
Well, right. I mean, he's giving you his worldview off the get-go. He's saying, what he's saying to us is this dog is suffering in a way that is useless. I don't have patience for useless things. What is the point of allowing this pain to continue? The dog's going to die anyway. I might as well end this useless aspect of its suffering now. It's not even right or wrong. I mean, he doesn't really operate on a right or wrong spectrum. He operates on a useful, useless spectrum. And this was a useless thing. So let's remove one more useless thing from the world.
My guest is Bo Willimon, the creator and showrunner of the Netflix series House of Cards. It stars Kevin Spacey as Frank Underwood, a ruthless politician who will do anything to climb the ladder. In season one, he was the Democratic House Majority Whip. By the time season three, the latest season, begins, Spacey has maneuvered his way into the White House and is now President Underwood. The First Lady, played by Robin Wright, is as ruthless as he is. She managed to become her husband's UN ambassador, but was forced to resign. As season three progressed, she became tired of always working to make him more powerful and taking a back seat to him. Things came to a head in this scene.
We earned this together. I said that to your face the first day I walked in here as president.
It's your office, not mine.
I have not made a single major decision without asking your opinion first.
But see, that's it. You make the decisions. Anything that I want, like the UN. It made me ill, Francis. My stomach turned.
Why? Because you had to resign.
No, because I had to ask for your help in the first place, that I couldn't get the confirmation on my own.
And what is wrong with asking for my help when you need it?
The fact that I need it. I hate that feeling. It's not me. I don't recognize myself when I look in the mirror. I do things like I did in the hotel in Iowa. I can't even talk with you about
it. Instead, you want me to slap you around like some animal.
That's what we are when we strip everything away. That I can understand.
It was deranged, begging me to take you like that.
And you couldn't even give that to me.
If you wanted a husband who proved his manhood to you that way, you should have stayed back in Dallas with your mother and married the prom king.
Well, at least I would have known where I stood.
No, you can't have it both ways. You want an equal partner when it suits you? You want a man to take charge when it suits you? And I'm supposed to what? Just divine when you want which? Stop being so selfish. You're better than that.
I'm not being selfish.
You are. We're in the middle of an election, and look at us.
That's exactly it. Look at us, Francis. We used to make each other stronger, or at least I thought so, but that was a lie. We were making you stronger. And now I'm just weak and small, and I can't stand that feeling any longer.
All right. What do you want? What is the damn alternative? Please, Claire, tell me, because I don't understand. All I am hearing is it's not enough. That the White House is not enough. That being First Lady is not enough. Not enough.
No. It's you that's not enough.
Let's talk about the relationship between now the President and the First Lady. In this season, you've decided that the President and the First Lady will have some friction in their relationship. She wants more independence. She wants more power of her own. She wants more authority that isn't dependent on his authority. So what made you want to head in that direction? And I'll preface this by saying a lot of marriages have this same issue.
Well, it wasn't so much that we were heading in a direction for the first time. When we really looked at the story, we realized we've been heading in this direction all along. We know that the ascendancy of Frank and Claire Underwood is due in large part to the mutual strength that they share. They make each other stronger. They rely on each other for counsel, for all sorts of things, and love. The only person whose approval Frank really cares about is Claire's, and it's deeply important to him. And when we started thinking about the third season, we always ask ourselves, what is most important to the story and how can we take it the farthest? One of the, probably the most important thing to the story is this marriage. And if we've seen strength for two seasons, the most scary thing for us to do was to question what would happen if that marriage dissolved, if it broke apart under the stresses that come from the White House. We've seen times where Claire and Frank have had a great deal of friction, largely due to the same issue of her suppressing her own ambitions and goals for the sake of his. And the argument always is that his goals are their collective goals. And if he achieves the presidency, then they both can do what they want with their lives. And I think she's coming to terms with that fallacy that she herself has convinced herself of. But this is the first season where we actually see that pressure break the marriage.
Beau Willimon is the creator and showrunner of the Netflix series House of Cards. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancuri.